Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. Today, I am bringing you the second part of an interview with Dr. Virginia Armbrust, the director of the School of Oceanography at the University of Washington. We'll be talking more about the world of unseen life in the oceans. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So a little hint. I spotted the familiar creatures who make this sound in the subalpine country at Mount Rainier last weekend. But I could have seen them in the wintertime as well. And this is just one of the many sounds that these little fellows make. Later in the program, I'll talk a bit more about this critter. But first, let's look at some recent observations in our area. And with the help of Charlie Fleischman, our sound engineer, Charlie.
Nature Now host Mary Robson reports that while on the coast near the Ozette site, at low tide on Saturday, August the 4th, a mother black bear stepped out of the forest with two cubs. They were poking about at the low tide line, rather unbothered by about eight hikers nearby, including Mary and her family. A passing ranger said that the bear was in her territory, but that none of the rangers had ever seen her with cubs before this moment. Mary marveled at this unforgettable ocean experience sight.
And during the low tides this past weekend, Wendy Feltham made another excursion to the rocky intertidal zone at Salt Creek County Park west of Port Angeles. Last month, I was able to go with her and reported the extraordinary number of intertidal fish we saw. I couldn't go with her this past weekend, but I did get a report from Wendy, and she posted some lovely photos on iNaturalist. Wendy saw hardly any fish this time, so different from last time. Echinoderms seemed to be this trip's themes. There were masses of brilliant purple urchins, many deep orange blood stars, and bright orange sea cucumbers, licking the collected food from each of their feathery tentacles. Small six-armed stars, three daisy brittle stars, those are cousins of the more familiar sea star, and the largest ochre star Wendy thinks she has ever seen. It was about 18 inches across. Let's hope this is a sign of the return of healthy sea star populations.
Closer to home along Port Townsend's North Beach, Wendy's iNaturalist postings show a photo of the small but fascinating oval-anchored stalked jelly attached to seaweeds close to shore. Imagine that you turn a tiny jellyfish upside down and add a slender stalk to its umbrella-shaped bell that anchors the little animal to seaweeds, and you have a stalked jelly. And down at the Indian Island Marrowstone Beach, Wendy spotted several hundred Lewis's moon snail eggs cases. These odd sand-colored structures look and feel rather like the rubber flanges on toilet plungers.
Wendy also posted another curious photo. It was a crow holding a live fish in its beak, perhaps an English sole. Have any listeners ever seen a crow fishing? Drop us an email to let us know if you have. At naturenow@kptz.org. And as the week progresses and the moon begins to grow again in the night skies, look for Spica, the brightest star of Virgo, standing below the moon in the evening. The moon is also flanked by two bright planets. Jupiter, the giant of the solar system, it's about 11 times the Earth's diameter, and Venus, the evening star. And looking just a bit below the moon, you can see one of the brightest stars of the constellation Libra, Zubanel Janubi. I just had to say that word. That is a great name for a star, Zubanel Janubi. As I mentioned earlier, I'm talking with Dr. Ginger Armbrust. She's the director of the School of Oceanography at the University of Washington. This is a recorded interview from last February when Ginger was in Port Townsend to give a talk at the Marine Science Center. In the interview, we'll be talking about that strange and weird world of microscopic organisms that populate the world's oceans, and why we should know about them and even care. A biological oceanographer, Ginger's research focus is on phytoplankton, primarily diatoms, the single-cell silica that's like glass encased beauties of the sea. So, Ginger, it's wonderful to have you with us again. And I'm going to remind people that we did an interview with Ginger, and I'll give you the podcast number at the end of the show. And Ginger's a phytoplankton person and has a lab at the School of Oceanography that does phytoplankton. Mm-hmm. So let's start with just some basics. Talk to me about what phytoplankton are and why they're important in the sort of world.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Nan. So let me tell you a little bit of first about what phytoplankton are.
Okay.
So they are microscopic, and some might say that they're like plants. So they're like plants in that they know how to take basically air, whether it's in the atmosphere or in the water, mm-hmm. and take CO2 and use a little bit of sunlight, a little bit of nutrients, and turn that into organic carbon. Okay, and the reason that's important is because these little microscopic organisms are generating about half of the oxygen that's newly created on our planet every year.
That's a massive amount, yes.
That's a lot. And they're generating about as much organic carbon as all of the land plants as well.
So food.
Food. So they are serving as food for most of the organisms that live in the ocean. Some form of food for them.
And then I'm sure if you sort of follow the food web through, you will get to
whales.
Whales and land animals. And
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so they play this very important role in helping to recycle things on our planet. And they live with a world that is largely unseen to us, that is filled with other kinds of plankton, small bacteria, small viruses, little tiny crustaceans that are feeding on them as the base of the food web.
And so I'm thinking, if there were no plankton, mm-hmm. could you extrapolate and say you'd have half the life forms on the Earth, maybe?
Well, what I can
now?
What
I'm guessing there.
What I can tell you for sure is that let's don't even really play this out in our mind,
okay.
But if there was no life in the ocean, okay?
Okay.
Remove all the life in the ocean. I can tell you for sure that the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere would be much, much higher than it is today. That's because these organisms, the phytoplankton, are removing some of that CO2 mm-hmm. from the atmosphere. They take it up and they turn it into organic matter. And a little bit of that organic matter, that food, most of it's consumed in the surface ocean, mm-hmm. but a little bit of it sinks out of the surface ocean to fuel the rest of life in the ocean.
The folks in the
deeper waters,
zone, yeah.
Right? And then an even smaller amount makes it all the way to the seafloor, where it's buried in the seafloor, this small amount, and that, in turn, over geological time, becomes oil. So they play a very yeah. important role in our planet.
So we talked a little bit the last time about some of the instruments and technologies mm-hmm. you use to study these sort of unseen critters.
Uh-huh.
Tell me a bit what it's like to be on shipboard studying plankton. What is that like?
That is a wonderful question, Nan, and thank you for asking me that, because going out to sea is a wonderful experience. It's something that few people mm-hmm. get to do. We basically get on board a ship, take all of our lab equipment. So we make a floating lab.
Mm-hmm.
We pack up our lab, haul it onto the ship.
So, and you have really specialized equipment we and have, stuff. So that's, we a, have that's lots, a big deal.
We have lots of stuff that we pack. They have to crane it on board the ship. Then we unpack it. We tie everything down because, remember, when you're out at sea, the ship moves. The seas are not always calm.
Right.
So everything is strapped down, tied down, nailed down, and then we start our work at sea. There's activities going on 24 hours a day. You sleep when you can, and you work the rest of the time. And we all work very hard out there. Sometimes it's really rough out there. But I guarantee you, Nan, there's always a time when I walk out on the back deck or out on the bow and look out and think, there is nowhere else I'd rather be.
Wow.
I look out and you're confronted by the vastness of the ocean, the complications of studying the system. Mm-hmm. The water moves by and you try and grab a little bit of it and figure out how it works. But there is that moment always when you're out there and you just think, this is it. This is the life. This is where I want to be.
If you had to pick a particular day that you found sort of the most exciting or fulfilling, I'm going to say from a scientific perspective as well as from a fills your soul perspective, and I know I gave you no warning for this, but what did happen on that day?
Many of the days out there are extraordinarily fulfilling. And let me tell you why they're fulfilling. One is, of course, I don't go out by myself. I go out and I'm surrounded by young, energetic, early career scientists that are equally excited to be out there. And they, I guarantee you, they can work a lot harder than I can as I've grown a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And they are working hard, and you can see the excitement and their enthusiasm in being out there. So that is something that constantly fuels your work out there. Then the other is, one of the things we love to do is look under the microscope. And you see something under the microscope, and it's very exciting, just because the organisms are beautiful. Or we bring out with us lots of different instruments that give us real-time data as we're out there. And so we'll all be down in the depths of the ship watching what's coming over the computers, and it's just really exciting. Or then we hear someone scream and say, hey, there's a whale out here! And we all go running out to the deck to watch the whales go by.
I find it really interesting that you're able now with modern technology to get real-time data.
Yes.
And see it as it's happening.
Yes.
That must be just amazing.
It is amazing, because before being able to do that, you'd go out to sea and you'd have a plan based on prior knowledge of how things were working, and you'd have set stations, we call them, set locations where we would go sample. And sometimes you'd pick the right station, and sometimes you wished you'd picked that other one, but you didn't really know that until you got back on land and could analyze
and
the
data.
Right,
and could analyze it.
Lots of our instruments tap into a seawater system that's positioned at about 8 meters or so at the bottom of the ship, and that seawater is coming in continuously on board the ship. We hook into that, and so we get continuous readouts of the organisms and the chemistry, the temperature as we move along. All of that is routing through to the computers. There's big screens on board the ship so we can watch what's going on. And you asked me about an exciting time, Nan. One time I remember the ship was having engine problems, and the captain told us that he wanted to turn around and start heading back by 7:30 that night. Okay, but a colleague of mine and I were watching the computer, and we wanted to hit a particular spot in the ocean. We'd gone there going north, and we wanted to hit it again going south. And I remember we were watching that computer screen to see if we'd gone far enough to see it. And I hear over the intercom the captain saying, how much longer? We need to get going. And we were watching it, just seeing if we were going to make it to that place, because my colleague and I had predicted we were going to get there if we could just go another 30 minutes. we're almost ready to turn around. Just give us 30 more minutes. And we start to feel the ship slowing down. And as we're slowing down, we hit our point. And wow. We could see it, and we were all very excited. And, okay, we can turn around now. So that was very fun. And that comes from being able to have the real-time data.
I just can't imagine the power of having real time, of being mm-hmm. able to compare what's going on, mm-hmm. see what's going on. Mm-hmm. I imagine you change the questions you're asking.
Of course
all the time then.
Of course you do, because you see a new feature that you hadn't expected. Mm-hmm. And so you can either stop and do your sampling there. You can turn around and go back. It's fun to call the captain and tell him to turn around and go back and resample that.
That same spot?
Yeah, that same spot, that same feature mm-hmm. in the ocean.
When I think about the ocean as a whole, we know phytoplankton, living phytoplankton, are going to be in the zone where there's light.
Yes.
But sort of across the oceans themselves, how does the, say, overall population of phytoplankton vary across the oceans?
Remember I said at the start that phytoplankton are sort of like the plants in your garden. Mm-hmm. They require light, and they require inorganic nutrients. They require the same things that you put in your fertilizer. They require nitrogen, phosphorus, trace metals, those kinds of compounds. Where are those compounds coming from in the ocean? Well, they come primarily from land. Mm-hmm. So you always see more phytoplankton closer to mm-hmm. land, because there's more nutrients mm-hmm. there. And so if we were to go out and look at the color of the water right offshore, you'd see it's kind of got a greenish tint.
It's a little murky, yeah.
Yeah, and that's because there's an abundance of phytoplankton mm-hmm. there, and they turn the water that kind of greenish color, which is really good for any of us that like to eat fish, mm-hmm. because these phytoplankton in these coastal waters are supporting some of our more productive fisheries. Mm-hmm. These are the large group of phytoplankton known as diatoms that are living near the coast and supporting these fisheries. If we were to go further offshore to the middle of the ocean, far from land, you'd see that the water is much bluer. And that's because there's far fewer nutrients there, and there's a lot of phytoplankton, but they're really teeny phytoplankton. Mm. And so they're a completely different type of phytoplankton out there.
That can live with the lower nutrient supply.
Correct. That yeah. they can live with the much lower nutrient supply. So these phytoplankton out in the middle of the ocean, the most abundant one, you could fit about 100 of them side by side across a human hair.
That's amazing.
Not the length of the human mm-hmm. hair, the width of the human hair. So that's how tiny they are out there in the middle of the ocean. They're very small, but they're also really mm-hmm. abundant. So they are the most abundant photosynthetic organism on the mm-hmm. planet.
Then how does the phytoplankton population vary with latitude, say between the equator and the Arctic?
It, again, will really depend on the nutrient concentration. Mm-hmm. So at the equator, you'll see these really small guys out in the mm-hmm. in the middle of the ocean. When you go up into the Arctic Ocean, you see that there's little light there. It's a short mm-hmm. growing season. And so for much of it, there's not many phytoplankton. Then the sun starts shining, there's high nutrients, and you get these big, what we call blooms. Mm-hmm. You get this big bloom of phytoplankton. Much of them are these large diatoms that will undergo these big blooms.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
Yeah.
It's another sort of distribution question. Is that kind of pattern then repeated in all the oceans?
Yes, yes, it's always repeated, always a much higher abundance of the phytoplankton near the coast, mm-hmm. much different kinds of phytoplankton out in the middle of the ocean. So you have very different food webs along the coast mm-hmm. versus out in the middle of the ocean.
So now a lot of us, of course, are reading about the impact of changes in our climate. Mm-hmm. And we think about in the ocean, we think about ocean acidification
yes.
and some of the issues there.
Yes.
On an earlier interview, I talked with Dr. Curtis Deutsch about changes in the oxygen distribution.
Yes.
From a phytoplankton standpoint, what concerns you about the changes we're seeing in our oceanic world
yeah.
from the phytoplankton's perspective?
We know that the oceans are getting warmer. The surface ocean is warmer mm-hmm. than it was. We know that as there's more CO2 in the atmosphere, there's more CO2 in the ocean, which causes it to become more acidic. Mm-hmm. We know that humans love to live near the coast, and as we put more pressures on our coast, what concerns me most is that we're going to have blooms mm-hmm. of phytoplankton, some of which produce toxins.
Mm-hmm.
The red tide,
quote unquote,
yes.
Yeah.
Some of which do that. We're going to have different kinds, maybe not toxic producing ones, but different kinds of community structure that different organisms might not like to eat them,
mm-hmm.
right? I can tell you something like
yeah.
that is going to happen. I can tell you that there are certain kinds of organisms, including certain kinds of phytoplankton, that make shells that are very sensitive to acids, to
mm-hmm.
acidified ocean, that we may change their distribution.
Mm-hmm.
I can also tell you that this change in temperature causes changes in circulation patterns, which will influence community composition.
That's changes in large-scale ocean currents.
Yes, changes mm-hmm. in large-scale ocean currents will change the delivery of nutrients,
mm-hmm.
which in turn will change the kind of phytoplankton. I worry about this because, well, I love phytoplankton, but the rest of us should worry about this because these marine food webs are dependent on these organisms. And which organism is where will influence what food web is
mm-hmm.
there. And which food web is where influences the organisms that are feeding
yeah.
on those food webs. So it really has this huge ripple effect all the way through the food webs. I wish that I could tell you, Nan, interview me again in a year, and I'll have figured this out.
But no,
because we have such limited understanding mm-hmm. of how our marine ecosystems work.
I think it's really profound, your comment, that what worries you or concerns you the most is that we don't know.
Yes.
And we really have no really good way of knowing.
I can't tell you that until we reach this tipping point, everything's going to be
mm-hmm.
fine. I can tell you that things are changing, and they're changing much more quickly than they have in the past. And I can tell you that it is the ocean and the ocean ecosystems that help make this a habitable planet.
Mm-hmm.
So in my worst scenarios, it's not a good scenario.
Mm-hmm.
In my daily scenarios, I set out to try and understand how this system
mm-hmm.
works. And I do that for two reasons, one of which is I think understanding how the natural world works is profound.
Yes, I completely agree.
And then the other reason I do it is because I know that these organisms have such a major impact on these global cycles.
Mm-hmm. Thank
yes.
you so much. This
okay.
has been fun.
Yes, thank you very much.
So as I mentioned, this was part two of my discussion with Dr. Ginger Armbrust. You can find the podcast from part one by Googling KPTZ Nature Now Podcast Ginger Armbrust, or by going to the KPTZ website, that's kptz.org, and looking for podcast number 348, The World of the Unseen Life in the Oceans. So now let's hear that mystery sound again. Those were the calls of the gray jay. According to the Cornell Ornithology Lab website, gray jays have a wide variety of calls, from harsh chatters to clear whistles. They can also imitate the calls of their predators, including owls, hawks, merlins, and pine grosbeaks. This mimicry may confuse the predator or signal a threat to other gray jays. Gray jays sometimes even snap their bills while chasing away intruders. The deceptively cute gray jay is one of the most intrepid birds in North America, living in the northern forests year-round and rearing chicks in the dark of winter. highly curious and always on the lookout for food. Gray jays eat just about anything, from berries to small animals. They may even land on your hand to grab a raisin or peanut. During the summer, they hoard food in trees to sustain themselves through the bleak winters. They clearly earn their nickname, camp robbers.
But we will need to learn to call them by their newly approved name, Canada Jay. From the mid-19th century until 1957, this little corvid was known as the Canada Jay. Then in 1957, the common name was officially changed to Gray Jay. The name change was considered a double slight by many Canadian ornithologists and birders, the loss of a national moniker compounded by an Americanized spelling of gray, G-R-A-Y, not G-R-E-Y. Just this past May, the American Ornithological Society, the scientific body that's responsible for the classification and naming of birds in North America, voted to restore the species' official common name, the Canada Jay.
Looking forward, and also with Charlie Fleischman's help, what's coming up?
Every Wednesday in August, the Jefferson County Clemente Course, Finn River Farm and Cidery, and the Jefferson Land Trust are co-sponsoring a special series, Thinking Through the Land, an engaging series of speakers and discussions centered around local humanities and natural history topics. On Wednesday, August 15th, Deanna Pindell will talk about art and place. Then on August 22nd, Holly Hughes will focus on poetry for the bioregion. Both events will be held at the Finn River Cidery. And for a really special outing, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society for a Nea Bay pelagic field trip all day on Saturday, August 18th. Aboard the MV Windsong, the group will venture out into open ocean, first north into the strait, then northwest to Swiftsure Bank, then south towards Juan de Fuca Canyon, with a final leg back towards Nea Bay around Tatoosh Island. This outing has the potential for albatrosses and thousands of shearwaters, along with humpback whales. Reservations are required, so go to the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website for further information.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12.05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ, that's at 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5.05 p.m., and Saturdays at 12.30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.